Okay. Well, I think I might get underway. I'm sure a few more people might come in, but my name is Robert Clark, and I'm the Chief Scientist in Residence, is my official title here now at the School of Art and Design, although there's only one of me, so I'm not sure what the chief means, but I'm the scientist in residence here. And I've only been here for a short time, for just over 6 months. This is actually the first symposium of its type. My role here is to look at things at the intersection of arts and science. Just a week or so ago, I described to the faculty a connection that we've made. Can you hear? Okay. How's that? I'm sorry. Just over a week ago, we described a big new project that is going to get underway here in connecting some medical research with immersive visualization and the construction of a very large facility to do that. But today, we're going to talk about a topic that I guess you've all read the abstract, but the topic is really looking at art and physics connections, and how they sort of come together in the broader sense, in our quantum description of the world. And there's going to be the subject of consciousness will come up, and we've got three speakers to cover this. We've got a scientist, Professor Gerard Milburn from the University of Queensland. Gerard and I, in another life, were sort of co-directors of the Centre for Quantum Computer Technology, and I was on the experimental side, and Gerard was on the theoretical side, and between us, we got an initiative underway, which continues to this day in a reinvention, a second generation of that, as reflected by Andrea Morello here and his team, young team. So Gerard will be talking about quantum, well, the subject of quantum computing. Gerard, actually, I've asked each of the speakers to say a little bit about themselves, to introduce themselves. But Gerard is probably the pioneer of quantum physics in Australia. Gerard wrote several books on this subject long before other people were thinking about it, and wrote them in a way that could be understood by the general public, which is I think is a skill in itself, Gerard. But Gerard will talk to you from a scientific perspective. We then have an artist, Paul Thomas, who will be well known to people here at the Faculty of Art and Design. Paul will be looking at the same subject, not exactly the same subject, but from his perspective as a professional artist, who for most of his time probably spends a lot of time thinking about painting, among other things, Paul, as head of painting and drawing here. Then beyond that, we have a hybrid of both Gerard and Paul, namely Joel Pearson. Dr. Joel Pearson was a COFA graduate, is now working in psychology in UNSW Brain Sciences, and so is sort of like both an artist and a scientist in one body, working on areas associated that sort of touch on consciousness. Now, the nice thing about this symposium is I have no idea what's going to happen. We haven't done this before. I'm not sure what Gerard's going to really say, or what Paul's going to say, or indeed what Joel's going to say. It'll sort of evolve. But the thing that we're all trying to touch on here is, can these different perspectives give us a better understanding of this quantum description of the world? So with that brief introduction, I'm going to hand over to Gerard as our first speaker. Each speaker is going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then I'm going to moderate a discussion where we can ask lots of questions. So, Gerard.
Okay, thanks, Bob, for that introduction. So I'll say just a few words about myself before putting up a few slides. Yes, Bob and I spent 10 years developing the Centre for Quantum Computer Technology, which is into its probably its 15th year now. We both left around 2010, so there's another generation taking that forward, including Andrea and some of the people at the back. Now I'm involved in running a new centre, which is also quantum technology, but not quantum computing. That's the Centre for Engineered Quantum Systems, and there's a very great deal of interest worldwide in new technologies, particularly in sensors and clock technology that can be improved dramatically using quantum physics. I've been at the University of Queensland for quite a while, heading on to 27 years, and I'm a theoretical physicist, although I've spent a great deal of my time working with experimentalists over the years. Okay, so let me begin. I want to start with something which is actually very obvious now. In fact, it's so obvious that we never stop to think how truly remarkable it is, and that is the scientific method or the experimental method itself. And this began when Galileo, among others, realized that you could learn something important about the world by isolating a small part of it sufficiently from its surroundings, interrogating that, developing laws which would then apply to everything. This seems so obvious to us now that we've forgotten that this was in fact disputed when it was first proposed. To Aristotle and the Greeks, it would have seemed remarkable that you could learn anything universal about the world simply by studying how balls roll down sloping pieces of wood. Nonetheless, that is the way it is. It's profound because it need not have been like that. The world is built in a particular way which enables that approach to work. And I put that in the context of a learning algorithm or a learning agent. So it begins by separating the world out into two parts, the agent, that is the experimentalist, and the small subsystem, which is the experiment and how it interacts with the world. The agent has a set of tools which it can use to act on the world. So this agent is embodied. It can go out and change things in the physical world, in particular in the small subset called the experiment. And it can make measurements and, using sensory data, extract information from that small subsystem. And of course, there's always the presence of noise. And it's the fact that the system can be isolated sufficiently well that noise, which can never be avoided, can be made sufficiently small that it can be managed, that enables us to do physics at all. What goes out from the agent is just a series of commands, which could just be a binary string. Ultimately, that's what it will be. But that, what's going out, has been constructed in reference to what comes in. So the key thing is, what, after a while, when this has been running, if you're looking at it from the outside, it looks like just random binary strings are going out and random binary strings are coming in. If the agent wasn't able to compare those in a history-dependent way, it would just look like a random number generator, but because we know it isn't, there's a very great degree of correlation between what goes out and what comes in, and on the basis of those correlations, something can be learnt about the physical system of interest. So that's the essence of the scientific method. The key thing to emphasize here is that from the outside, looking at the agent, it just looks like another physical system in the world. That's what you are to me. Well, perhaps a little bit more than that in the case of some people, but you are physical systems, part of the external world. But the inner experience of the agent is unique to the agent because it's based on a history-dependent, stochastic, fluctuating random sequences of inputs and outputs. And that is what's truly unique about each and every individual agent. So on the basis of that, inside the agent, so I'll use this little speak bubble here to capture what's going inside the head of the agent. The agent is comparing these input and output strings, trying to construct correlations in terms of conditional probabilities. If I push on X, Y will change in a certain way. If I push on X, Y won't change in a certain way, and thereby learn something about the world. And in a classical experiment, one believes that this is telling you something about X causing Y. Our fundamental understanding of causation is based on this idea of agents intervening in the world and seeing what changes. And there is another way to express it, and that's to put it in terms of some mathematical function. In other words, the output depends on the input. And that's the ideal of classical physics, and that's what will fail in the quantum world. So how complex is the analysis that the agent is actually doing here? Well, we know it's pretty hard work because it took a long time to invent the scientific method in the first place. The Greeks didn't quite get it. They got close. Then it was lost for a very long time. But it wasn't until the 14th, 15th century, and the 16th century in particular, 17th, finally, with Galileo, that things really got underway. So it's not a trivial task. But what I'm interested in is, in terms of mathematics, how difficult is it? And why is it possible at all? So what we need to be able to determine is, what is the probability that some hypothesis about the world is correct? Why X causes Y? Is that true or is that not true? It's either one or the other. So this is a real question about computational complexity, and it depends on the kind of problem you are dealing with. Not every problem can be learned in this way, by pushing on things and seeing what changes. What matters is how the size of the problem, how the number of computational steps required scales with the size of the problem. And of course, there's always error, so you could always run the machine longer and longer and longer, or just keep doing the experiment forever and forever and push the probability of being wrong down to a very low number, but you have to stop somewhere. So there's always a trade-off between the number of steps and the time it takes to do the learning and the error involved. So the amazing thing is that for many problems, it is learnable, in that the number of steps doesn't rise exponentially in the size of the problem for a given bounded error. So these sorts of algorithms that I'm talking about here, learning algorithms, there's a huge body of computer science literature now dedicated to that, and you are all familiar with that because it's now an extremely valuable technology. In fact, Amazon recently announced they're now selling access to enormous servers which will enable you to implement these algorithms. It's pretty hard to do it in your head these days, but if you can put it in a spreadsheet, so they claim, you can run it through their artificial intelligence learning algorithms, Bayesian causal nets, to try and back out correlations inherent in the data that might not be obvious. And of course, that's a big deal for Amazon, and it's a big deal for Google, because if they can do that faster than anybody else, then they can win. So you might ask, well, in that Amazon cloud, what precisely is it? In the early days, it was something called the Mechanical Turk, and you would think, well, that's just a person, so here's the agent in this case, some scientific whiz kid. But in fact, of course, it isn't that. It's Amazon Echo, but of course it isn't even that either. You can go and buy this thing. It's like a sort of Siri on steroids, if you like. It just connects to the cloud. What's actually going on is somewhere in the world, possibly Ireland or Alaska or somewhere, there's this massive factory full of water-cooled computers all running together to do that complex data analysis. Okay. So the scientific method is a learning algorithm that we have learned to do on the world, and it's learnable because the world is built in a certain way. The classical world is built in a certain way. But if that's true, we can simply replace that agent with an artificial machine, just like Google is doing, and we can build in actuators and sensors into that device. That's what a robot is. And we can automate the entire process. Indeed, that has been done. There was this famous experiment from 2009, which just used motion capture sensors and a learning algorithm to extract the laws of physics from some coupled pendulum problem. They just pressed go and waited, and through a combination of genetic algorithms and learning processes, it was able to extract the constants of motion and the corresponding laws that governed this thing. And of course, Galileo and the rest of us spent centuries trying to do that. Admittedly, we already knew what the answer was, so it was easy to check. It wouldn't be so simple if we didn't know the answer, but... So the key lesson here is the world of classical physics, the world of Newton and Maxwell and Einstein, is in fact learnable. It's of the kind of problem that can be learned through a finite or not exponentially increasing number of steps for bounded error. That immediately leads you on to thinking about the world itself as a classical computer. We can simulate the classical world, because if we can learn it efficiently, we can build a machine to produce outputs in response to inputs that would just completely simulate what the real physics was doing. And indeed, we can do that of classical physics. Unfortunately, the world isn't classical. It's only approximately classical. And why it even looks classical in the first place, when it's in fact quantum, no one's ever really managed to get to the bottom of that problem. But it is quantum. Ultimately, the world is quantum, and that's just the way it is. But it's the same basic process. We have a quantum world, we have an agent, we have experiments. So what is the quantum world? Well, this is the world discovered by Bohr and Heisenberg and Schrödinger 100-odd years ago. As everybody knows, it's deeply puzzling and nobody understands it, not even people like me who get up here and talk about it. And I can't even, you know, I can see it in the equations, but here I'm not going to put up any equations. You've seen all you're going to see. And so I have to try and find some way to explain it as best I can without referring to equations. But it's deeply counterintuitive. But the question is it still learnable? The first key lesson of the quantum world is that the physical universe is irreducibly random. It is not like the classical world, where you'll learn more and more and more about the physical system until there's no more uncertainty left. This will never happen in the quantum world, which is the world we live in. It's a bottomless pit of random numbers. So you might ask, how is physics possible if that's the way it is? Well, it's because of the very strange way in which quantum physics generates randomness. Because even within that complete uncertainty, for every physical state that you know perfectly well, there's at least one physical quantity which is perfectly predictable, and simultaneously one physical quantity which is completely random. And that's always true for every physical system. And it's the strange way in which the world is built that requires us to invent a new calculus of probability to actually understand what's going on. So in classical physics, we maintain the fiction that we're learning about facts that are there regardless of whether or not we look at them or not. In the quantum world, the objective facts are simply the results of measurements. There's nothing more. In other words, the facts are the binary string going to the actuator and the binary string coming from the sensors. They're the facts. What we put in the box to explain that is our invention, and that's the quantum theory. It works incredibly well, it has to be said. It's the best physical theory we've ever come up with in terms of quality of its predictions. But it works pretty much the same way. We send out numbers to tell the experiment what to do. It can all be automated. We get numbers back, and we compare the correlations between input and output, construct relations between probability distributions, and that's where we stop. We do not make factual claims about things in the world beyond that. But it turns out that is enough to build a learning machine, and that is enough to control the quantum world, and that is indeed what a quantum computer is, and that's what a quantum technology is. Learning algorithms that tell you how to control the world at the level of the quantum. So we could try the same trick. We could set up artificial intelligent agents, just robotic machines, to learn about the quantum world. And to some extent, this does indeed happen in the lab. Otherwise, the PhD students would never get home or have dinner. It's largely automated, but not completely. But in the future, it could well be completely automated. What about the next step? What about trying to replace the world itself, the quantum world, with a computer simulation? Well, we know now that that will fail. That cannot work. Because you can never simulate the classical learning process with a classical, the learning process required to generate quantum correlations from a classical computer. You would have to have a quantum computer. And the Center for Quantum Computer Technology and many of the other centers around doing this are trying to build machines that would enable a perfect simulation of the world we live in, which is the quantum world. And of course, we could also have a quantum artificial intelligent agent. And this is where it really starts to become interesting, because the real question now is, if quantum computers can simulate the real world and classical computers can't, would a quantum artificial intelligent agent learn more efficiently than us, assuming we're classical, which may not be true, I don't know, or a classical artificial intelligent agent? So the real issue here is, what is the computational power of learning machines built around quantum processes? So Google has a hunch there's something going on here. They've started putting hundreds of millions of dollars into this effort. Last year, they announced the world's first quantum artificial intelligence lab, which will be based on superconducting quantum computer architectures. And they're particularly interested in learning machines and quantum speed-up to Bayesian networks. But we also know from this beautiful theoretical work from Hans Bregel at the University of Innsbruck that there is indeed a computational advantage in building learning machines based on quantum technologies. This would be what's called a quadratic speedup. So instead of taking a million days to do a search on a data set, it might take 1,000 days. And that might be enough, almost certainly would be enough, to give Google or Microsoft or IBM or somebody like that the edge in the competitive world of matching ads to potential customers based on searches. Or something perhaps even more useful. So, the real question now is, if we can build artificial intelligent agents based on quantum principles, what would it feel like to be a quantum agent, if you like? What is going on in the head of a quantum agent interacting with the world and learning about the quantum world? So some of these ideas were addressed in this fascinating paper by Hans Briegel, published a couple of years ago now, on creative machines and the physical origins of freedom. And one of the key things he points out is that because the quantum world is an irreducible source of randomness, this can become a key element in generating novel behavior in learning machines, something which can't be done in the ordinary classical world. So what he claims in this paper is that this model of an artificial agent, which he then makes quantum, demonstrates there's a notion of freedom which is applies to everything at all scales. There's no sort of spooky ghost in the machine or anything. It's just a machine. But it has a concept of freedom, or it embodies freedom in a way that's completely compatible with the laws of physics, and that the free behavior itself is something that emerges. It's not intrinsic to the actual specification of the device. It's the same sort of thing. He calls it a projective simulation. There's a number of key elements. It has to have a memory, and the randomness enters by the way in which the machine can explore what's stored in memory. What's stored in memory are simply binary strings correlating inputs and outputs, sensors and actuators. So these are big sequences of binary strings, which he calls clips. Stochastic processing takes place on these binary strings, and they're done in his latest work on a quantum device, so that's quantum random walks on these stochastic webs. And one very important fact, which is not clear when you read that paper, is that he found this thing would not function properly unless it could forget. It, because it's based on a kind of reinforcement learning, it would just get stuck on the wrong idea and just keep repeating mistakes over and over again. So he built in memory that would decay, which enabled it to come up with truly novel ways of doing things. Kind of curious. So here's the basic idea. Remember, this is all just in a machine. These are all just settings of switches, ones and zeros. There's nothing else in there. But something comes in from the outside world through a sensor. There's some sort of processing of these binary strings on a quantum architecture. So that's all ordinary classical everyday data. This is all ordinary classical everyday data. But what's going on there is quantum. And there's a feedback loop which changes the weights in which transitions can take place between these memories. The machine can also spontaneously combine pre-existing clips. In fact, it can write its own clips. It can write imaginary scenarios that it could then explore in the context of actual real data. And all of that can take place in a quantum architecture. So this will be a quantum stochastic network. Out there is the ordinary everyday world, but what's going on in there is purely quantum. Nonetheless, it can learn very efficiently how to function appropriately in the world. So let me just end with something a little bit provocative. So quantum artificial intelligent agents learn faster. We now know that. No one's built one yet, but it's not far away, as I've perhaps suggested with what Google is up to. They clearly can be more creative because they have an irreducible source of randomness running in the background. They may be more free if you follow Hans Briegel's argument. And in some sense, these quantum intelligent agents will be truly at home in the quantum world, which is the world we actually live in. So with that, I'll stop and move on to the next talk. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared. What we'll do is we'll just defer questions until we've heard all the talks. So the next speaker